Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more of America This Week, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129. Now back to America This Week, live with Father Matt Malone and Kerry Weber.
And we are back. You are listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129. I am Kerry Weber here along with Father Matt Malone, and we are talking with Phil Klei, talking about his collection of short stories called Redeployment, which was inspired by his service in Iraq's Anbar province in the U.S. Marine Corps. And we invite you to join the conversation, 1-888-3-CATHOLIC. It's 1-888-322-8465. Now, Phil, you dedicate the book to your parents and mention that they had three sons joining the military in a time of war. So I imagine that this book sparked some conversations between you and your brothers. One's a Marine, one's in the Army. Did they give you any feedback on this before you published it? Did they encourage it? Were they wary of it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, and also just my family talks about issues of war and peace for obvious
for
reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, not just my brothers who served in the military, though certainly talked a lot with them, but also, you know, with my family more generally. And, you know, one of the stories is told from the perspective of a Foreign Service officer. My grandfather, my maternal grandfather, was a career diplomat. So that undoubtedly had something.
Sure. Influence.
Some kind of influence, yeah.
Oh, interesting.
But you chose the Marine Corps, and what was interesting was certainly in this interview that you had with Kevin Spinelli, who is the moderator of the Catholic Book Club in America, you kind of introduced a bit of nuance, I think, into the stereotypes that people of all a lot of political stripes might have of Marines, right? And how they think and act. Like, and one of the things was that, you know, you said, well, what do we actually mean by toughness? Because there's resilience and there's a lack of empathy, right? And they are not at all the same thing, right?
Right.
And in fact, they're actually opposites, right?
Yes.
In a really important way. So I wonder if you could talk a bit about that, a bit about, like, what is it that we don't know that we should know that we misunderstand about the people who serve and the culture, say, of the Marine Corps?
Oh boy. well, I'll talk a little bit about the distinction between toughness and resilience, and I think that line gets crossed all the time, and it gets crossed in the military as well, where people think that a certain kind of sort of tough guy posturing is kind of the same as physical courage, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, there's resilience, sort of being able to endure a lot, and then there's being willing to inflict a lot. And there's a story in the book told by a chaplain where there's a unit that sort of becomes deeply embittered, and they're in a very violent place, and they have a commander who is incredibly aggressive and whose response to this chaos is more violence. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, the way I see it in military culture, the kind of quintessential hero is the guy who, you know, jumps on a hand grenade to save his buddies, right?
Right.
This is not somebody who has killed any of the enemy, actually. He's just given his own life to save his friends. And so oftentimes in kind of popular culture, there's an obsession around inflicting harm. You know, pretty much every veteran at some point has been asked, did you kill anyone, right? Which veterans really don't like being asked. The popular books, like, you know, the deadliest sniper, or, you know, deadliest soldiers in the American military is another one. You know, versus you know, a notion of somebody risking something, right? Which is and self-sacrifice, which is central to the military,
right? And it's also not a solitary effort, right? I mean,
yes.
Right. I mean, it is the action of a group, or
yes,
or it doesn't happen at all.
Right. Right. There's a, you know, a lot of the way that we talk about the way the military functions in popular culture. You look at sort of individual heroes making a huge difference in discrete encounters, but usually it's a unit. Right? War is an industrial process. There's a right. huge machinery. There's a line by the poet Kenneth Koch, served in World War II, as machines make ice, we made dead Japanese soldiers.
Right.
Right. Which is, you know, maybe a little too dehumanized, but
right.
That's very different from, you know, the kind of American Western version of heroism.
Right. I thought the view of the experience and of war through the eyes of the chaplain was a really interesting way to go into that story. And I think because in some ways he's very much a part of everything and then also somewhat removed in this strange sense. And the way in which he talks about prayer and saying prayer does not protect you, which I think a lot of people would immediately associate with folks at war saying, you know, protect me, please protect me, please, which I imagine is a very valid and reasonable prayer. But he talks about the fact that that's not its purpose, right? It's about that relationship with God. I wonder if you could talk about how prayer during your time at service sort of changed your relationship, if it did.
Well, I mean, just the thing about it is you, when a unit goes to war, any unit that was deploying to Iraq in early 2007, casualties was something they could expect.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And, you know, there are units in Afghanistan, in Sangin, there was one platoon that took 50% casualties, right? People killed or, you know, injured, amputations. And that's one thing. I think, you know, we focus often on the number of people killed. There are a lot of people who have suffered very grievous injuries. And those numbers often don't get talked about as much. And so, you know, there's a way in which if you sink too much of your faith in the expectation that suffering will, that you will pass over, that it won't happen to you, that's going to put a whole lot of dents in your faith, because it's just not, it's not how it works.
And also the chaplain isn't a witch doctor, right?
Right.
Right. Who, you know, or some wizard accompanying the Roman legion who's opening up the entrails of a dead animal and discerning like which direction they should go.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So it's, it's,
though,
I mean,
though if a chaplain did that, the Marines would probably kind of like it.
Fair enough. That's probably what I'd do.
You don't do that for us at work.
No, I don't. Yeah. But I can also understand why you would want to do that, because you'd like to have your presence feel like it had this. I mean, I related immediately as a priest to this chaplain.
Right.
You would like it to feel like your presence here has a real efficacious, presence, and
that you can control something.
Exactly, that you can control something. Right.
That you know, the world is not as chaotic as it is.
Right.
Right. I think that's where that sense of humility, in the sense that we were talking about before, comes in, and that it's really so much of what Pope Francis talks about. So much is that accompanying that a chaplain goes along with everybody side by side in solidarity, but can't necessarily protect anybody. It was a couple years ago, I went to Wilford Hall Medical Center in San Antonio and to the Brooke Army Medical Center there to interview some Air Force chaplains who were training to go over to Iraq and Afghanistan. And part of the training was watching surgeries of people, going into operating rooms and watching surgeries, so that when you go to Iraq or Afghanistan and you see the inside of people's bodies in a totally different circumstance for the first time, you are not, you know, shocked, and you can still do your job. And I, of course, was shocked. I practically fainted in this room. I would not necessarily be a great chaplain in this circumstance, but it was, I mean, for 2 days. And then we went to the medical center and we saw and met and spoke with some of the guys who come back with the injuries that you're describing, 18, 19 years old. And I was there for 2 days and I was completely emotionally and physically exhausted by the end of that. And it just gave me just a wild admiration for people who actually live that out every day. And it's such a such a difficult situation to be in, such a stressful situation to be in. And one of the things that you talk about is the way in which everybody there is really interconnected. And one of the characters who comes back and is covered with scars from burns talks about the fact that his life was not saved, you know, in one moment. It was over and over and over again in the times where he was safe and no one really, you know, you don't know because everyone did their jobs well.
Right. The people who immediately responded when he was on the battlefield and the Kazovac crew that came and did their jobs and brought him back to surgeons who did theirs and this whole kind of chain and even the sort of revolutions in trauma surgery that have happened, the innovations in trauma surgery that have happened over the course of the Iraq war. Yeah. Every war sort of advances our medical knowledge.
And it seems such a beautiful image of the Christian life in a way of saying, you know, we're not saved once at the crucifixion in this sense, but over and over again, as we seek reconciliation, as we seek forgiveness, as we seek to better ourselves and by each other and by Christ mm-hmm. present in each other in our daily lives.
And the community that's been built up.
Exactly. The body of Christ that exists in our community. Exactly. No, that makes a lot of sense. I wonder if you can talk about your own kind of experience of being back here and relating in the way you've kept in touch with people or not, and how that community has continued or not.
Yeah, I keep in touch with some of the Marines that I serve with, particularly the guys I was in Iraq with. And actually, one of the nice things about going around on a book tour is that it makes it easier to actually see these people in person because they're all over the place.
Right.
And I've also become much more involved in the veteran community, which has been deeply satisfying. There's a pretty remarkable new generation of veterans, right? I mean, I think, you know, oftentimes when we talk about veterans, we talk about the things that are issues that they're dealing with. Veterans are also, I mean, you know, they vote more, they are more active in their communities, and they do charity work more often than their civilian counterparts, right? The same sort of call to serve that led people to join the military kind of often continues very strongly afterwards. And so it's been actually really deeply gratifying to not just meet, you know, veterans in the literary community, and there's a really strong group of literature that's starting to come out. More of the encyclopedists. There's a book by Matt Gallagher coming out. There's Green on Blue by Elliot Ackerman. A lot of books by veterans that are really fantastic, but also just that's doing all kinds of different things, whether it's at Team Rubicon, which is a disaster response organization, or, Pat Tillman Foundation, all sorts of good
a
stuff.
Lot of, a lot of service. As you said, it forced you to rethink your own citizenship.
Yes.
We have Tom on the line from Florida. Tom, you're on America This Week.
How are you?
Great.
I'm a Vietnam veteran. I spent 6 years in the Marine Corps, did two tours over there, and I've been listening to this conversation, and I come at it from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. When I came home after Tet 68 in Way City, the country was against the military men. We started seeing it in the Stars and Stripes newspaper, but by the time I got home and did go through San Francisco International Airport to fly home, it was very prevalent. And we didn't have any support out there. The American public didn't want to talk about the war. They've been watching it on television. And in some instances, people had seen loved ones get wounded or killed. Not because they were looking for it, but because it was on the nightly news. Mm-hmm. And we built our own support group, the Vietnam Veterans Association. And for a long, long time, we weren't getting what we needed to continue on with our lives. Now, I fared a little better than most. I was never into drugs. I had a good family support when I got home after my first tour, and that continued on. But we actually had men come home from Vietnam to find out that their wife had moved and left them.
Right, right.
You know,
right.
I've stayed in touch with some of the guys, and just within the last year, I've had two of those men have passed away. And, you know, if we as a group collectively in the military, I think anyway, said, this will never happen again, that we'll never allow the men and women who are sent overseas to do a job to be treated the way we were treated.
Right.
You know, it's not like we all got drunk sitting around a barracks one night and said, hey, let's go get our guns. We're going to go invade Vietnam.
Right, right.
Right,
and
right.
What exactly. You've mentioned so,
Tom,
brings up
thank
this,
you very much for the call. Thanks for sharing your experience.
It brings up this very important point of community that you were mentioning before.
Right, and that you know, the civilians are absolutely a part of it, right? These are not Bush's wars, they're not Obama's wars, and they're not the veterans' wars, they're America's wars.
Right.
And I think that, you know, we really do owe a lot to the Vietnam generation, and particularly I think that in the cultural conversation is not where it is in Vietnam, and I think that there's a much better sense of how unjust that reaction was, and I think, you know, we do have those guys to thank for that, and we should appreciate the experiences they went through.
Right.
And yet one of the things that came out of that this was a kind of distinction that we would make between supporting the troops and
right.
supporting the war. Right. I don't support the war. I do support the troops, and I understand that motivation where that comes from. It's because you want these men and women to feel supported, but at the same time, it also kind of puts that psychological distance. Like, in other words, it's not my war. Although I'm a citizen of the United States, it's not
right.
my war. It's someone else's, right?
Right.
And so it's a double-edged sword, isn't it?
Yeah, it's difficult. You know, I often find that I have, you know, I have more in common sometimes with people who I disagree with passionately, but they're deeply and seriously engaged with these questions, than I do with somebody who, for whom, their engagement is kind of a few slogans and that's it.
And it's interesting because you write about the fact that, like, the same war story could be funny or sad depending upon how you tell it. One of the characters says this.
Right.
But those aren't the only two things that a war story can be. And I think this is a good example of this, that depending upon the perspective on who's telling it and where you sit, this same sort of narrative can really be kind of skewed in many different ways. And we need to kind of make sure the conversations are going around this so that we don't see only one side in some ways.
Yes.
Well, we have been talking with Phil Klei, who won the National Book Award for Fiction in 2014 for his collection of short stories, Redeployment. Please pick it up. It's available wherever books are sold. And you can also read an interview with Phil in the July 20th issue of America. And I would be remiss if I didn't say that he's also a graduate of Regis High School here in New York.
Very proud graduate.
Indeed. Thank you so much for your service, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to be talking with America's world-renowned theater critic, Father Michael Tuath, about theater in New York City. So stay with us on America This Week.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to hear the full show every week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.